Imagine for a second, right, that you are locked up under house arrest.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And you have like a Roman guard literally chained to your wrist 24 hours a day.
Sounds miserable.
Right. The air is stagnant. The food is terrible. And you are facing this highly uncertain, potentially fatal trial before the emperor.
The stakes are literally life and death.
Exactly. And in the middle of all this, you decide to write a letter to your friends. Now, human nature says this should be a desperate plea for legal help or, I don't know, a long, bitter list of complaints.
Which would be totally justified.
Totally. But instead, you sit down and write a letter that is absolutely dripping with joy.
It's wild. It completely defies every psychological expectation we have about trauma and confinement.
Yeah.
I mean, when someone is facing execution, we anticipate despair, panic, or, you know, at the very least, a heavy sense of self-pity.
Right.
But the text we are looking at today is characterized by this radiant, almost defiant gratitude. It is just a masterclass in cognitive reframing.
And that is exactly why you are here with us for this deep dive. Today, we are exploring the Book of Philippians, relying on this deeply insightful introductory course taught by Dr. Matthew S. Harmon.
It's such a great course.
It really is. And our mission today is to extract the historical context, the frankly wild origin story of this specific community, and the core themes of the letter the Apostle Paul wrote to them.
Yeah, because when you strip away the centuries of stained glass and academic dust, this ancient text serves as a blueprint for mastering your mindset, building an unbreakable community, and finding resilience when you are quite literally trapped.
So to set the tone for how we're going to tear into this material, let's look at Dr. Harmon's own goals for his course.
Right. He frames his study around two primary objectives.
Okay.
The first is growing in devotion to Jesus, recognizing that for Paul, this text wasn't just some philosophical treatise. It was meant to foster a vibrant love for God and for other people.
Which makes sense, yeah.
And the second goal is understanding and applying the depth of the gospel in everyday life. He stresses that analyzing Philippi is, well, it's useless if it just remains an academic exercise.
We don't just want trivia.
Exactly. The goal is to figure out how to put these ancient truths into action right now in your own daily reality.
I love that approach because it really forces us to look at the practical mechanics of the history. But before we get into what Paul actually wrote from that cell, we kind of have to establish when and where he was writing.
Right, the setting.
Let's start with the timeline, what Dr. Harmon calls the redemptive context. What does it actually mean for a first century person to be living in a, quote, redemptive timeline?
So it means living with the dizzying realization that the climax of human history just happened in your lifetime.
Like you just missed it or you're in the immediate aftermath.
Right. We are situated post-resurrection. For these early believers, the promised Messiah has come, the Spirit has been poured out, and they are living in this era of explosive, unprecedented expansion of the church. The entire paradigm of how humanity relates to the divine has shifted. But the crucial piece of context here, and people forget this, is that the biblical canon was not complete.
Oh, that fundamentally changes how they experience their faith compared to someone today. I mean, if you have a theological question today, you just flip open a neatly bound New Testament.
Right. They didn't have that.
Not at all. It's like building the airplane while you're flying it. How wild must it have been to live your faith without the completed manual we have today?
It was incredibly vulnerable. When the Philippians received this letter, they didn't have a comprehensive theology textbook.
Yeah.
They might have heard a few oral traditions or perhaps had access to like one or two other letters circulating among the cities.
Yeah.
But the overarching written framework just wasn't finalized.
So they were relying entirely on these sporadic letters. You were dealing with intense persecution, community drama, and existential dread. And you get maybe one letter every few years. It drastically raises the stakes of every single piece of correspondence they received.
Every letter was quite literally a lifeline. And to understand why they needed that lifeline so desperately, we have to look at the city of Philippi itself.
The historical context.
Right. This wasn't just some quiet backwater village. Philippi was a leading city in the district of Macedonia, strategically positioned right on the Via Ignatia.
Which was like a massive Roman highway, right?
Exactly. A massive Roman highway. This made it a major trade route, giving the city a highly cosmopolitan, bustling vibe. You had goods, merchants, and radical ideas constantly flowing through the gates.
I know Dr. Harmon breaks down the demographics, and this is where I need you to connect the dots for me, because the numbers seem like a recipe for social disaster.
Oh, they absolutely were.
He estimates the population was roughly 10,000 to 15,000 people, right, with a heavy presence of farmers and military veterans. But what was the actual breakdown of who held power in this city?
That is the pivotal question. Despite Philippi being a very proud Roman colony, less than 40% of the population were actual Roman citizens.
Wait, really? Less than 40%?
Yeah. The remaining 60% or more were non-citizens who had virtually no legal rights, no social standing, and no political voice.
So the vast majority of the people living in this so-called mini-Rome were essentially second-class residents.
Pretty much.
The friction there must have been palpable.
It defined the entire culture of the city. Philippi was engineered to be a miniature Rome. Latin was the official government language, and the architecture mirrored the capital, even though Greek was the language you actually heard in the marketplace.
So you're surrounded by Rome, but you're speaking Greek.
Right. If you walked the streets, you were meant to feel the heavy, imposing presence of the Roman Empire in every aspect of civic life. And the most potent tool for enforcing that Roman identity was religion.
Right, because civic religion in the ancient world wasn't like modern personal spirituality. You didn't just quietly believe something in your heart.
Exactly. It was incredibly pluralistic. They had temples to deities like Silvanus, Dionysius, and all entities.
Just gods everywhere.
Everywhere. But the overarching umbrella was the imperial cult, the worship of the Roman emperor himself.
Wow.
Now, scholars debate how formalized the imperial cult was in Philippi at this exact moment in 50 AD. But we know that in a Roman colony, loyalty to the emperor was the glue of society. Participating in civic religious rites was how you proved you were a good patriot and a reliable business partner.
Which means stepping into that specific environment and declaring that Jesus is Lord, a phrase that inherently implies Caesar is not the ultimate Lord, wasn't just a difference of religious opinion.
No, not at all.
It was political treason. It was a direct threat to the economic and social stability of the city, which really makes the story of how Paul actually ended up in Philippi around 49 or 50 AD so strange. Because according to Acts 16, he wasn't even trying to go there.
It is a remarkable sequence of events.
Yeah.
Paul and his companion Timothy are on their second missionary journey, moving through Asia Minor, and they hit a literal divine roadblock.
A roadblock?
Yeah, the text explicitly states that the Spirit of Jesus actively prevented them from speaking the word in the province of Asia, and then the Spirit of God did not allow them to enter Bithynia.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's look at this closely, because I really have to push back on the logic here. From a human perspective, that makes zero sense.
It really doesn't.
Your entire mission is to spread this urgent good news. You are standing at the gates of major populated cities ready to preach, and your own God gives you a red light. If I'm Paul, I'm incredibly frustrated.
Well, for sure. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, it perfectly illustrates the intense tension between human strategy and divine sovereignty.
Okay, right.
Paul had a highly logical, efficient itinerary mapped out. But the narrative demonstrates that God's operational timeline is often radically different from ours.
Mm.
God had a specific geopolitical target in mind crossing the Aegean Sea into Europe.
Oh.
So Paul receives a vision of a Macedonian man begging for help, and they pivot. They sail from Troas to Samothrace, then to Neapolis, and finally walk inland to Philippi.
And when Paul walks into a new city, he usually has a very well-documented playbook. Step one, find the local Jewish synagogue and start reasoning with the people who already know the Old Testament scriptures. But he hits another wall in Philippi, right?
He does, because a synagogue didn't exist there.
Wait, no synagogue at all?
No. Under Jewish tradition, you needed a quorum of at least 10 Jewish men to officially establish a synagogue.
Oh, wow.
The fact that Philippi didn't have one tells us the Jewish population in this mini Rome was practically non-existent. So Paul has to improvise.
So what does he do?
He gathers his team, and on the Sabbath, they walk outside the city gates down to the river, hoping to find an informal place of prayer.
And what they find is a group of women. Specifically, they meet a woman named Lydia. And this is not a peasant woman. She is a seller of purple goods from the city of Thyatira.
A very lucrative business.
Extremely. In the ancient world, purple dye was extracted drop by drop from sea snails. It was astronomically expensive, reserved for royalty and the ultra elite. So Lydia is like a high-end luxury textile dealer. She is a businesswoman of significant wealth and autonomy.
She represents the cosmopolitan nature of the city perfectly. Hmm. And the text notes that God opens her heart to pay attention to what Paul is saying.
Amazing.
Yeah, she and her entire household are baptized right there in the river. And she immediately leverages her resources, insisting that Paul and his team use her large home as their base of operations.
It's this beautifully quiet, subversive beginning to the first church in Europe.
It really is. Mm-hmm. And there is this incredible little literary Easter egg hidden right in this scene. Dr. Harmon points out the pronouns in the book of Acts.
Oh, yeah. The we passages.
Yes. This is a brilliant, subtle detail. The author of Acts, traditionally understood to be Luke,
right,
usually writes as an external narrator in the third person. You know, they went here, he said this. But precisely at the moment the narrative arrives in Philippi, the pronouns shift. It becomes, we sought to go on into Macedonia, and we went outside the gate to the riverside.
So he's there.
Exactly. Luke is quietly inserting himself into the historical record, letting you know he was physically present for this. And remarkably, when Paul eventually leaves Philippi, the pronouns shift back to they.
Oh, strongly indicating Luke stayed behind to pastor this brand new fragile community meeting in Lydia's living room.
It's the ultimate stealth cameo.
I love that. But as beautiful as that riverside start is, the honeymoon phase does not last. We go from a peaceful gathering of luxury textile merchants to absolute public chaos. And it all starts, predictably, over money.
Money and exploitation, yeah. So Paul is navigating the city over a period of days, and he is constantly followed by an enslaved girl who is possessed by a spirit of divination.
Oh, the story.
Right. Her owners are using her condition to act as a fortune teller, and they are making a massive profit off her suffering. Eventually, Paul turns and commands the spirit to leave her in the name of Jesus. She is freed, but the moment she's freed, her owner's lucrative business model just evaporates.
Their profit margin vanishes in a single sentence, and they are enraged. But notice what they do next. They don't drag Paul and Silas to the local magistrates and say, hey, this guy ruined our fortune-telling monopoly.
Because that wouldn't hold up in court.
Exactly. Instead, they weaponize the city's civic pride. They drag them into the marketplace and claim, these men are Jews and they are disturbing our city. They advocate customs that are not lawful for us as Romans to accept or practice.
It is a textbook example of masking an economic grievance in the language of patriotism and civic duty.
Yes.
They tap right into that 40% citizen supremacy, and it works flawlessly. The crowd whips into the xenophobic frenzy, and the magistrates don't even bother with a trial. They just order Paul and Silas to be stripped, severely beaten with wooden rods, and thrown into the inner prison.
Let's talk about the reality of that inner prison, because it's vital for understanding the theme of joy later on. This isn't a modern holding cell.
No, not even close.
The inner prison is the deepest, darkest hole. It's suffocating, it smells of sewage, and their feet are locked in stocks. And these stocks weren't just wooden boards. They were designed to force the legs apart to induce agonizing muscle cramps.
It's basically torture.
Yeah. They are bleeding. They are in the dark. They are in excruciating pain. They are in terrible pain. And they decide to hold a midnight choir practice.
It's an astounding psychological response. They are praying and singing hymns to God, and the other prisoners are just listening to them. And then the narrative violently shifts again.
The earthquake.
Right. A massive earthquake strikes. It's so powerful that the foundations of the prison are shaken, all the doors fly open, and everyone's chains miraculously unfasten.
Which sets up one of the most dramatic character arcs in the entire New Testament.
Oh, absolutely.
The jailer wakes up, sees the doors wide open, and immediately draws his sword to kill himself. Because under Roman military law, if you slept on duty and allowed your prisoners to escape, you didn't just get fired.
Right. You bore the punishment the prisoners were meant to face.
Exactly. Which often meant torture and execution. He assumes his life is completely over.
But Paul shouts out from the darkness, do not harm yourself, for we are all here.
Wow.
Think about the shock of that moment. This jailer, who just hours before had locked these bleeding men in torture devices, rushes in with a torch, falls trembling before them, and asks the ultimate human question. Sirs, what must I do to be saved?
And Paul doesn't give him a complex theological exam.
No. He simply says, believe in the Lord Jesus and you will be saved, you and your household.
The reversal is just incredible. The captor takes them into his own home, washes the wounds he likely helped inflict, feeds them, and is baptized that very night.
That's a beautiful moment.
But the political drama isn't over. The next morning, the magistrates realize the mob has cooled down, they've made their point, and they send police officers to tell the jailer to quietly release Paul and Silas. Basically, just sweep this under the rug.
And this is where Paul exercises a brilliant tactical maneuver. He refuses the quiet exit. He sends a message back to the magistrates. He says, "You beat us publicly, uncondemned, men who are Roman citizens, and threw us in prison. And now you want to throw us out secretly?
Yeah.
No, let them come themselves and take us out."
It is the ultimate unblockable reverse you-know card.
It really is.
And you have to understand why this terrified the authorities. Under the Lex Valeria and other Roman laws, beating an uncondemned Roman citizen was a massive, career-ending, potentially life-ending crime. The magistrates hear the word citizen and they just panic.
Because suddenly they're the ones who have violated Roman law. They have to march down to the prison in person, formally apologize to Paul and Silas, and politely ask them to leave the city.
That is so satisfying.
But Paul isn't doing this to nurse his ego. By forcing a public apology, he establishes a protective legal precedent for Lydia, the jailer, and all the new believers left behind.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
The authorities know they narrowly escaped a scandal, so they will be terrified to harass this new church again.
He literally uses his privilege as a shield for the vulnerable. It's brilliant. So let's fast forward the timeline. Dr. Harmon jumps us ahead about 10 years to somewhere between 60 and 62 AD. What happens to this little church over a decade?
Well, 10 years is a long time to sustain a countercultural movement.
For sure.
The church has stabilized structurally. Paul addresses overseers and deacons. It remains a predominantly Gentile congregation. But their most defining characteristic, which sets them apart from almost every other church Paul planted, is their radical generosity.
They were funding his trips, right?
Exactly. They partnered with Paul financially multiple times, funding his ongoing missions when no one else would.
But they are exhausted. I mean, the initial adrenaline of the church's founding has worn off, and they are facing a slow burn of economic and social persecution.
Yes.
Plus, Paul also warns them about false teachers trying to enforce Jewish laws on Gentiles and a vague group he calls enemies of the cross. And on top of all that external pressure, there is serious internal drama.
Yeah, and Dr. Harmon highlights a very rare pastoral move by Paul here. He specifically calls out two female leaders in the church by name Euodia and Syntyche and publicly pleads with them to agree in the Lord.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Think about the social dynamics of this. You are sitting in Lydia's crowded house church. Someone is reading this highly anticipated letter from Paul out loud.
Right.
And suddenly he says, "And by the way, you two in the back row need to stop fighting." It's the ancient equivalent of a CEO CCing the entire company on a private HR dispute.
It is incredibly awkward.
Right.
But it proves how vital unity was to survival. If those two prominent women fractured the church, the community would collapse under the external Roman pressure.
That's true.
And we know how desperately Paul cared for them based on the delivery mission of this very letter. Paul is writing this while imprisoned again, most likely under house arrest in Rome, chained to an imperial guard.
And the Philippians, being the generous people they are, here he is in custody and take up a collection. They send a man named Epaphroditus to deliver this financial gift. Now, carrying heavy coin across the Roman Empire wasn't like sending a digital transfer. You faced highwaymen, extreme weather, disease.
And disease is exactly what hits Epaphroditus.
Oh, no.
He falls deathly ill on the journey. Word eventually trickles back to Philippi that he is dying, and the church goes into a panic. Then Epaphroditus finds out that his friends are panicking, and he becomes deeply distressed that they are distressed.
It's this incredibly touching cycle of mutual anxiety driven by deep, genuine affection.
It really is. I just love the humanity in that detail. It grounds the whole text.
Thankfully, Epaphroditus survives. He completes his mission, delivers the funds to Paul, and Paul sends him back to Philippi carrying the document we've been building toward, the letter to the Philippians.
Which brings us to the actual mechanics of what he wrote. Dr. Harmon outlines the letter in three main sections.
Okay, what are they?
First, the introduction. It completely reframes Paul's imprisonment, arguing that his chains have actually advanced the gospel among the imperial guard. Then, the main body challenges the Philippians to live as citizens of heaven.
Right.
And this pivots around a stunning piece of poetry known as the Christ Hymn in chapter 2. Finally, a conclusion focused on gratitude for their financial partnership.
So what does this all actually mean? How does a person's mind bridge the gap between sitting in a Roman cell and writing a document characterized by the theme of joy? because Dr. Harmon lists joy and rejoicing as the dominant themes of the letter.
It requires understanding how Paul defines joy. He isn't talking about, you know, circumstantial happiness.
Like having a good day.
Exactly. He is talking about a profound cognitive remapping based on the theme of the gospel. For Paul, the good news of Jesus wasn't just a ticket to the afterlife. It was the ultimate reality that ordered everything else.
I see.
If the ultimate reality is that Christ is king, then Rome's power is an illusion. That realization breeds a defiant joy.
And you don't sustain that defiant joy alone. This ties into Dr. Harmon's third theme, fellowship or partnership. The Greek word is koinonia.
Yes, koinonia.
It's a word that implies deep, shared participation. You aren't just attending a meeting. You are in the trenches together, sharing your money, your safety, and your resources.
Exactly. And that koinonia is sharply focused by a fourth, highly fascinating theme, the day of Christ.
Right.
This raises an important question about how Paul utilizes ancient texts. In the Old Testament, there's this terrifying, looming concept called the day of the Lord. It was understood as the cataclysmic end of history, when God would finally intervene to judge evil and set the world right.
But Paul takes that deeply Jewish concept and completely rebrands it for a Gentile audience in a mini Rome.
He adapts it into the day of Christ. He takes Jesus of Nazareth and places him at the absolute center of cosmic judgment and the culmination of human history.
Wow.
He is telling the Philippians, I know the Roman magistrates seem powerful right now, but you need to live your lives in light of who is actually going to judge history.
Which demands a totally different way of living. And that brings us to the final theme, proper mindset. Dr. Harmon is crystal clear that Paul is not just asking them to adopt a new intellectual worldview.
No, it is highly behavioral. Adopting the mindset of Christ means adopting his exact mechanism for moving through the world.
And Paul explicitly defines that mechanism in the Christ hymn of chapter 2, right?
Yes. He describes how Christ, though being in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant.
That's so powerful.
In a Roman colony obsessed with status, citizenship, and power, Paul is saying that the ultimate path to joy is actually humility and sacrificial service.
That is the psychological secret right there. If your joy is tied to your status, the moment Rome throws you in the inner prism, your joy is gone.
Gone entirely.
But if your mindset is identical to Christ's, if your goal is to humble yourself and serve others, then a prison cell doesn't strip you of your identity. It just changes the location where you serve. You can't threaten a man who has already given up his ego.
That is precisely the mechanism. And to validate this radical new operating system, Paul continuously draws on the Old Testament. Even without direct quotes, he uses the ancient Hebrew narratives to explain the identity of God's people.
Yeah.
He anchors their current terrifying reality in Rome to the ancient, unshakable bedrock of God's historical plan.
And that is the ultimate takeaway for you listening to this deep dive right now. The letter to the Philippians isn't just a fragile piece of ancient papyrus. It is a highly tested, incredibly durable blueprint.
It really is.
It shows you exactly how to cultivate unshakable joy and build a resilient community, even when your personal circumstances feel completely out of your control. It is historical proof that your mindset can radically transcend your immediate situation.
Which leaves us with a final provocative thought to consider. Think about what Paul accomplished by taking that ancient, intimidating concept of the day of the Lord and completely reframing it into the day of Christ.
Yeah.
He used ancient wisdom to radically alter how these people viewed their ultimate reality, and it gave them the courage to face intense persecution without losing their joy.
Absolutely.
It begs the question for all of us, if Paul could use those ancient narratives to so completely reframe their terror, how might we be failing to use the stories and wisdom available to us today to reframe our own modern anxieties?
That is absolutely a thought to chew on as you go about your day. We are so quick to panic, and maybe we just need a fundamentally different lens through which to view our circumstances. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the streets of Philippi.
It was a pleasure.
We hope this gave you a few serious aha moments and a fresh perspective on how to build resilience. Keep exploring, keep asking the hard questions, and we will catch you next time.